That suit's a little revealing, isn't it?
Well, it allows for maximum mobility. Feels like I'm wearing nothing at all.
Quit it! Must wash eyes!
Uh-oh. Okay, don't panic. Remember what the instructor said.
If you ever get into trouble, all you need to do is...
Feels like I'm wearing nothing at all. Nothing at all. Nothing at all.
Stupid sexy Flanders. Ow, my leg. This is the worst pain ever. Go, go.
Ahoy, hoy, everybody, and welcome to another Talking Simpsons interview. I am one of your hosts for this one, the stupid, sexy Bob Mackie, who is here with me today.
It's Henry Gilbert, and I also have come down with leprosy today.
Oh, no. Check to see if it's oatmeal.
And delicious.
Yummy. And who are we talking to today? We're talking to Carolyn Omine. If that name doesn't ring a bell, she's been writing for The Simpsons for the past 22 years, and we just referenced it up front. Her first episode was Little Big Mom, which we recently covered on the show.
Yeah, she has worked on the series for literal decades now, and not just, you know, as a writer on the show or co-executive producer or executive producer even, but she's also, you know, has been a voice director on the series too. She has so many fun stories to share. You know, we mainly focused on her early years on there, since that's what we're covering right now, but she had so many fun stories to tell. What a nice person too. One of our, yeah, the nicest people we've talked to.
And we go into her pre-Simpsons career, including Full House. We got the dirt on John Stamos. You're going to hear about it in this podcast.
we learned a ton about that, and easily enough to fill a second podcast we could do. And so, yeah, I think you guys are really going to enjoy this. Again, a big thank you to Carolyn Omine. Follow her on Twitter. It's just her Twitter handle name, and follow her on Instagram too. And, you know, if you enjoy this interview, we have a ton of previous ones too. I think it's over 30 now.
I'm pretty sure we're up that far. We talked to quite a few people over on patreon.com/talkingsimpsons. They're all at the $5 level. Our previous interviews for the first, I think, like 2.5 years of our Patreon, we've talked to people like Mark Kirkland and David Silverman and Mike Reese and John Vitti, and I keep going and going. There's a lot. There's a lot of people. I think we've covered about half of the writers to date at this point.
And it was great to hear Carolyn's perspective on such a long time on the show and her very varied experience on it. And also, you know, being one of the only women in the writer's room for a time too. We learned a lot from her. So big thank you to her. And I guess why don't we just go into the interview? My first question is an easy one, but like, what got you to start your career in comedy?
I guess career-wise, I was doing a lot of improv and sketch, and I wrote a lot of sketches for that. And I was in an improv group with a guy who's Mark Steen, and his sister was Nancy Steen, who was a TV writer at the time. And so she was familiar with my sketches and stuff because she had come to a bunch of our shows. I was also working in a literary agency, and she called one day looking for writers. And I was like, oh, hi, it's me. And and so she told my boss, who was a literary agent, Rob Rothman, the fabulous Rob Rothman, that, you know, she said, you know, your assistant writes. And she said, you should represent her. And he said, well, you should hire her. And then she said, well, tell her to give me a script and maybe I will. And so he came out and he said, you should write a script. And so I wrote a script and he got it to her and she hired me. It's crazy. It worked. It was very, very lucky. But that's how I got career-wise. But I had been doing improv and sketch comedy for a long time, and that's what sort of prepared me for.
Yeah, I was curious. You know, how would you compare like the improv scene when you were getting started to what the improv scene, at least in LA of now, kind of feels like? Like, do you notice similarities or differences?
It's very, you know, I did, and I'm not good at judging time, but I did, I want to say 5 years ago, just, I took a class at UCB just to, is that right? Upright Citizen.
Yeah.
I sometimes call them USB, and then like people would correct me, like, I'm like, what am I saying it wrong? But UCB, I just did it. It was, I just missed doing improv so much. And I wanted to do that. And it was really interesting to see a different comedy theory. And it always feels weird to think like that comedy has theories, because on one hand, it's like this artistic thing, like, well, there's no, comedy has no rules, but it does. And I think it actually, there are, you know, it's like religion, I think, you know, there's many ways to get to God. And sometimes you need to look at what somebody else did. And so it was very, I thought that the UCB, their whole thing, I don't know, are you familiar? Are you in improv at all?
We know it a little. We're kind of on the outside, but we have lots of friends who work.
Yeah, I mean, they have a very specific thing about finding the game of a scene and then repeating the game of the scene and resting it and then coming back. And they get very... when you do improv, like sometimes we were trying to create a sketch off the top of our heads, basically. So we were trying, basically, and there were other little rules. It was all that like yes and no deny and all those things. But, you know, when I used to teach improv, I used to like time people, because I would say like a really good sketch would be about 3 minutes long. And so at 1 minute, you should have had your premise sort of set. And by 2 minutes, you got to like leap to action and then you start reaching for an ending. And I just felt like internalizing that clock was a, you know, just something to do. But it's very different because UCB, yes, UCB, I thought I said it again. USB. UCB, they would get very like, oh, wait, you're getting plotty. Because I would be trying to tell a story and they'd be like, no, you're just repeat the game. So that was interesting. When I look at some Saturday Night Live sketches, sometimes I think, oh, that's what they're doing, is they're like, here's the premise. Here's another example of the premise. Here's another example of the premise. You know, I like things to go, here's these people. Something happens to them and then there's an ending. But that's, I think it's harder to do. And you have, you know, there's just in the old school, it was a lot more, you just kind of had to accept some of them aren't going to, they're not all gems, you know?
Yeah.
But I feel like with the newer version with this, and they also have, this long form is very, mostly people do long form now, and that allows you to like, oh, it's starting to lose steam, somebody jump in and, you know, take the scene to another, like take one word and go off in another direction. So it's incredibly entertaining to watch, because I do think old improv, short form improv, you would have sometimes these moments of, you know, wow, I can't believe this is just being made up. And then you'd also have many cringe moments. I think improv was a lot less enjoyable to watch just because you'd feel like bad for people. But and I think now you kind of like, there are people like, there's no dead air, because it's like a movie trailer. They're trying to go for like a movie trailer as opposed to trying to create a sketch.
Yeah, I think in the past 10 years there's been a great amount of improv awareness, at least increased awareness, because I really got into improv comedy via podcasting, networks like Earwolf, where local LA improvisers would just do scenes for a podcast. And I think before that I would just associate it with Whose Line Is It Anyway? I'm like, that's the only improv I know, that's like the only version of it that's possible. But now I know long form and short form and all the different rules set up by the UCB. So yeah, how do you feel about that? There was not really a platform like that to like disseminate your comedy.
It's hard because, you know, for a long time, back in my day, a lot of people thought that improv couldn't be on TV. It wouldn't work. And I feel like watching Whose Line Is It Anyway, I kind of felt like, yeah, it doesn't really work. part of it is that, well, I liked what I would call open scenes, but as exercises, you would do games. You would do things like, you know, like every time this guy touches his ear, that person will fall down. Or there's a thing we used to called Actor's Nightmare, which I think is a great game, where one person has a playbook, like a book of plays, and, you know, the audience would open it up to any point, and then you'd read one character's lines and the other person has no idea what play you're doing, and you know, you get a suggestion, so you're like two auto workers, but meanwhile this person is only going to be saying lines from Glass Menagerie, and the other person has to justify and make all of those lines make sense. And I think those are great, because, you know, even if the audience just wants to see an attempt. And they actually kind of want to see you fail too. Like, that's funny too. So I think in that kind of thing, I think that worked really well in television. I feel like Whose Line Is It Anyway? I haven't seen it in a long time, but that's, they basically were doing these games, which to me would be more like exercises. But I think in television, that's kind of, you know, why I think it doesn't work is that when you're watching a scene and it's actually happening and it's just a scene and it, and you're watching it live, there is that thrill of like knowing this is happening live. Mm. I feel like you don't believe it if you see it on TV. It it feels like, yeah, they could have cut and edited that, or I don't know. I'm not sure why, but I, yeah. So for a long time I thought, well, I don't know if improv will ever really work on a TV. And I know that UCB does a podcast, and I haven't heard improv on a podcast level. Maybe I think that could work.
Well, it depends on the improviser too. Like, yeah, they have to be certainly trained for it. Well, so once you got into the industry, there was one of your big shows before Simpsons was Full House, and we definitely have some Full House questions.
Yeah, that was surprising to me because it is a very non-Simpsons show. And I say this as someone who has a lot of affection for the old Full House show. I watched it sincerely as a kid and then ironically as a teenager. And how did you find yourself on that show? And what was the atmosphere like compared to what would happen later in your career on The Simpsons?
Well, so the Full House was, you know, I had been on a couple shows before that, and one was a, you know, it was like we have 20 episodes and we're out, or not, no, not 20, 14, and we're out, and then it didn't go any further. And you know, it was I was so excited to have to be able to go on hiatus and come back and know that the show would still exist. So even though I wasn't like, I watched the show and I was like, I don't know, this is my cup of tea. Like, I don't know if I would have watched it had it, you know, because I was younger person and didn't have kids. But I was like, all right, I won't have to like worry about coming back after hiatus and wonder if there's any jobs. But it was a very happy place to work. Hmm. Everybody was really nice. Nobody had any attitudes, and the actors were all very nice. And the writing staff was very, I don't know, happy, diverse, funny. It was, you know, to be honest, the writers knew that. I feel like the actors and the people on stage were like, this, they, when the Emmys would come out, they'd be like, why don't we win Emmys? And I was like, we're Full House. Why don't we win an Emmy? But in the writing staff, they were like, mainly it was because the actors used to paraphrase all the time. That was what they do. Like, I love John Stamos. He's super nice, but like, he'd sort of been taught early on that the script is just a starting point. It's like an outline. So if you gave him a joke that was like, why did the chicken cross the road? If he was supposed to say, to get to the other side, he would go, well, it's what I would call to get to the other side, per se. Like, he kept saying per se, like he didn't know how to use it, but he kept throwing that in there. And he also learned these little tricks, like he told somebody once, like he told another actor, and then they told us that, like, if you walk while you talk, they can't edit around you as much because you'll jump, you know, you have to sort of keep all of that, or at least keep part of the cross. So I feel like a lot of the writers were sort of demoralized and also with a lot of notes, you know, from the network. So you just were sort of churning out what you could. And I remember sometimes somebody would be like, but does it make sense that he would be so obsessed with his hair? And then people look at him like, oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I'm holding us up, you know, dealing with logic. Let's keep moving. Yeah, it was a very particular thing. And so something like The Simpsons is very different in that to be at a place where people were, one, you know, our actors are very, very respectful of us. And so they also, we work as, you know, together, we do take their improvs, but they will always give us at least one take that is what we wrote. So, you know, it makes sense to, you know, really think about the wording of a joke, because they're not going to just plow right through it and say it however they want to anyway, you know. So I think that dynamic between us and our actors at The Simpsons really keeps the writing morale up and keeps the writing good. And I think that there was sort of this spiral of like, you know, the writers were sort of, we didn't have as much influence as the executives, who would be like these young people who have like came up from marketing and now they got moved into being executives on the show, and they would, I think they got paid by the note. No, I'm sure they didn't get paid by the note, but they wanted to sort of justify their job by giving notes. And so they would give these, you'd see they'd have all, like they'd have worked on these notes. And I remember this was on a different show that I was on that was also very note heavy, but there was like, it was called Stand By Your Man. And it was these two women whose husbands were in prison. And at one point somebody said, you mean I have to drive 150 miles to this prison? And then like the note was, can we make that 200? Because 150 is a little wordy. And so, you know, like, all right, great, great Titan. And then when we changed it, the actor was like, whoa, well, why is the prison getting further away? Like he was thinking that was meaning his part was going to get smaller. I feel like a lot of shows, not just Full House, but a lot of shows of that era, the writing really suffered because the writers were so at the mercy of the notes. And then also, you know, the actors could just do whatever they want or not do your thing or, you know, and yeah.
Speaking of the writers on it, I did see in your years on it, actually, I think it was the teleplay of the episode right before the last episode you wrote is credited to Adam I. Lapidus, who mm-hmm. is also, he wrote a Simpsons before going on to Full House. Did that Simpsons work ever come up while you guys were working on the show?
Yes. I mean, he mentioned it a lot. Yeah, he did. He did a freelance episode. Was it The Front?
Yeah, The Front. Yeah.
And I think he had knew Sam Simon. And so, but that was like, yeah, it was early in his career. He did a freelance episode for The Simpsons. Yeah.
Did you know you were writing the last episode when you were writing that
season? Full House?
Yes. Yeah.
Yes.
I like, was it officially canceled by that point when it was assigned to you?
Yeah. We knew that it was towards the end. And my first draft, we all, there were a lot of, and there, I don't know how much stayed. There were a lot of sort of swipes at the show, good natured swipes, but I think there is, because she has amnesia, right?
Yeah.
And that Michelle has amnesia. And I think she sort of says like, wow, this house looks so much bigger on the inside than just on the outside. That was always the thing. Like, you know, that the exterior they would show of this little townhouse, but there was always like, here's Joey's room and you know, and Uncle Jesse and Becky are like, they've got this giant, like there were so many rooms, and every once in a while there'd suddenly be a basement and another kitchen and whatever. It was just,
yeah. When Jesse and Becky moved into the attic, I think that was the first time as a kid I questioned like, how big is this place really?
Oh, we've got an attic now.
Yeah.
Why didn't they, what did they use the attic for before? It was just this empty room.
So you eventually would move on to animation writing with some classic Chupo shows like Ah Real Monsters and Wild Thornberries. How did you first start to, you know, broach this new frontier?
I actually did those while I was, like, because I was at Full House, and then I went with Mark Warren and Dennis Winsler, who ran Full House at the time. They went on to do a show called The Parenthood, and I was writing with them, and it was sort of similar shows, but not as successful. But I had a friend, Mark Steen, whose sister gave me my first job. He was running Real Monsters. And he said, look, you know, if you ever want to do one of these during your hiatus, they're really fun. And, you know, we don't get much notes. So I was like, oh, yeah, I wrote an episode, and he changed very little, and it was, you know, they recorded it, and I was so excited. It was very, it was such an exciting thing to me to be like, wow, something that doesn't get all diluted and changed. And so then the next hiatus, I had another friend who was also from an improv group I was in, Mark Palmer. He was running the Wild Thornberries. So he said, you know, do you want, so I wrote one for him. But then at that point, then Klasky, Chupo, and Nickelodeon, they started deciding, we're going to give notes. And and it was like back and forth. And it wasn't as bad as like network and studio notes on the other shows that I've been working on, but it was enough because the money was way less. It was way, 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 way less. So like the only reason I was doing it was because, so I was like, can I say?
Yeah, sure. Go for it.
I was like, fuck no. I was like, shoot. This is exactly what I do for much more money. Why would I do it? You know, the only reason I wanted to do it was to just for artistic satisfaction of being able to write something and not get it all changed. But it was also the first time I wrote, and those two, writing for animation and just sort of going, wow, this is cool. Because with, especially writing sitcoms, you know, like in a show like Full House, you have this giant stage. So you have so many sets, despite how big the house was on the inside, but you could only have one or two swing sets. I mean, literally because of the size. So it'd be like, if we've got a giant store, then we can't go to Jesse's apartment, Aunt Becky, and you know, like certain things would have, like if the Smash Club is here, we can't also have this. So you'd have to write scripts knowing with those things in mind, how, you know, you can't have a bunch of swing sets. There's only so much real estate we've got in this stage and budget and all that other stuff. But then you go into animation and none of that is a consideration. You can go to the moon if you wanted and you can have thousands of people. Like, you know, if you look on those old shows, sometimes, you know, somebody would turn to somebody like, you know, the hot dog vendor and go, "Can you believe it?" And that guy's just got to go like, "Oh," like, you know, because he can't, we can't afford another person speaking, you know.
Yes.
Which we never have. We don't in animation, you know, we have our fantastic cast and they do so many different voices. And that's true of most animation actors. You could have a salesperson come in and that person can have a great part and be a strange character. And it can all, you know, this is, you know, one of the great things about animation. And I think The Simpsons really benefits from that. And I mean, you know, Bob's Burgers, you know, all of us, but it is this, you know, idea that you don't have to just have these same people and you can go anywhere and everybody can talk.
Did working on those, you know, prepare you for when you applied to The Simpsons and in season 11?
I think it certainly helped me when I write my scripts and think about the shows. Are you asking if it did it help me get the job? Or know that it did. I don't know that they knew.
Okay.
but I mean, I might have mentioned it to Mike Scully was the person who hired me, but I had been recommended from by Brian Scully because I had worked with him on a show.
Oh, okay.
So yeah, I mean, I might have like it in my interview, but I can't remember. I've said, "Hey, I also did this Saturday morning cartoon, so I know how to." It definitely helped a little bit in the thinking. Although I think that, you know, we've had writers start on our show who have no animation experience and you pick it up.
So how did the hiring process work for you for season 11? And were you concerned that your work with more traditional sitcoms might be seen as a strike against you in that Simpsons world?
I knew it was going to be a strike against me to like some of the fans. And I think I remember when I saw like on that bulletin board before there were like websites, they were like, "We just found out Shiro for Full House." I kind of was a little self-conscious. I didn't think I was as good as these other guys because mainly everybody else had such stellar credits and including that they were all from like Ivy League schools. And I was I had graduated from UCLA, but I started at the University of Hawaii. And, you know, so yeah, there were a lot of things that made me like kind of feel like I better just work really hard. I didn't start in season 11. I actually started a little bit earlier, like almost towards the, I started in season 10, but it was a whole season before I got a script. Cause there was most of the episodes were assigned and then for the first season. And I remember it was like me and Tom Martin, they're like, "You guys can have a pitch off basically." Like we both were gonna like go and write stories and then we'd come and we'd have to pitch them. And only one of us was going to get a story. Cause that's all we had this year. And then maybe next year you could get a script. And they also said, at this point, we've got enough Homer and Bart stories. So it's got to be a Lisa or Marge story, and which are a little harder and because they're not as splashy. And then Al Jean came back. And it was like, so we're like, tired already. Like, okay, here's the big pitch out. And then Al is like, "Oh, wait, are you pitching stories?" And we're like, "Well, Tom and I are." And then he's like, "Oh, I got stories." So he just pulls out this notepad and he's like, "Oh," and then he pitches this story about Homer becoming a food critic. And then, you know, it's like, "Oh, that's great." And I'm like, "Yeah, because it's got Homer. And so we were like, duh. And the script goes to Al. So yeah, we were, Tom and I were like, well, maybe it's next year.
When we interviewed Mike Scully, he mentioned early when he started there, you know, it felt really intimidating to him, especially all these, you know, Harvard guys, and it's such a famous room. He was intimidated to pitch jokes for his first like few episodes on the show. Do you remember the first time you pitched a joke and it got on the show?
I do. I remember exactly what my first joke was. And it's actually probably for season 9, because we were always rewriting. Or maybe it probably was, I don't know. It's the Vegas show.
Oh, that's 10. I think that's early 10.
Is that Viva Ned Flanders?
Yeah.
Right. Is it Viva Ned Flanders? I remember my first joke was, it was a sign joke that got on the air because it was something that was late in production, where it was like, it was in a color and it was almost ready to go. They were like, we just need a couple more signs as you go down the boardwalk. And so I pitched Loosest Craps in Town.
well, that's a great first one.
That's a classic poop joke.
I was very excited about that. And yeah, I did watch it on TV like, yeah, but so it was a while before. So it wasn't until season 11 that I got an episode.
And at the time, I believe that Julie Thacker was the only other female writer in the writer's room. How has that changed over time in the past 20 years?
Well, Julie was like a consultant, because she was, yes. She wasn't in the room as much, but yes. So for a long time, I was the only woman. We had Valentina for a while. It was me and Valentina. And then I want to say, again, I'm bad at estimating time. I would say like she was there for about 5 seasons, maybe 6, I guess, because we have to go in even numbers. Yeah, probably 6. But now in the last few seasons, we have many women. We have Christine Nangle. We have Jessica Conrad, Elizabeth Kiernan Averick. we had Megan Amram for her. She was on our show during the weeks that she was off from The Good Place. So yeah, she was sort of doing what I was doing, like a much more high caliber version of what I was doing, where she's just like The Simpsons. So she just spent her breaks with us. She did it for 2 seasons. And now she's developing things, so she's off into the wild blue yonder.
Was it tough at first being like the only woman regularly in the writer's room then?
It was tough at moments. I mean, for a lot of times I felt like it just kind of felt like, not like one of the guys, but I just felt like another writer. I felt like it took a moment to win everybody's trust, I guess, to like let them know that I was one, you know, I at least competent and as good as they were. And I don't know, I think there was a moment early on where people were afraid to make raunchy jokes around me, and then I made raunchy jokes and they realized, oh, okay, all right. But it definitely, there are things that are difficult about it, and I'm so glad that it definitely is a difference to have more women. It just is an energy feeling of it feels good. But you know, it's one of those things where it's like, yeah, it wasn't easy being the only woman, and there's a lot of things I could complain about, but I sort of don't want to, because I don't want to you feel like when people have evolved, I don't want to be like, yeah, but you know what they used to do was this. And because yes, we were getting better, but also it was, you know, it still is this really interesting, funny room of fascinating people. And I will say, all of them, I'm sure me too, we all have strange, weird opinions about things. And so yeah, there was a couple times I was like, what are you saying? That's crazy. But that's sort of what makes them so brilliant. Everybody, one of the most brilliant people, and he doesn't write with us anymore, but was John Schwartzwelder, he was never in the room on a daily basis, but he did a lot of episodes. And when he came in, he was always so interesting, because he kind of lives with his brother, and I kind of feel like that he's kind of not interacting with a lot of other people. So when he would come to the room, he would just be full of conversation and full of like theories about the world. And, you know, he was, he, I remember he really hated Bill Clinton, and at that time, I think Clinton was president. He was like, I think he had a bet with somebody that Clinton would leave office being chased out of town, and he would, in a car, and he would be firing at the people. Like this was his prediction of what would, and we're like, you know, seriously think this is going to happen? And that's just another, that's a very extreme example, but you know, sometimes you just kind of go, all right, you're brilliant. You have some strange thoughts.
It is amazing for us to hear people who have actually talked to John Swartzwelder. We think of him as this J.D. Salinger figure that no one has ever seen in like 30 years. But I didn't actually know like he was actually still coming in to deliver his scripts. I thought he'd just like throw him over the wall from his Cadillac and peel off.
No, he would, he would be here for a couple of days.
Oh, wow. Okay.
To do while we worked out the stories. And, you know, my early days of writing in sitcoms, like one of my first rooms I was in pre Full House, everybody smoked. I used to smoke. I was like right there on the, I mean, apparently just before I got there was other things happening in the rooms. But at this point it was just smoke. I remember there's one girl on the staff that I was on this show, Home Free, early Matthew Perry vehicle. Mm-hmm. And she didn't smoke, and I always felt so bad for her. They would put a fan, like, you know, facing outward, like, well, this will suck the smoke out. And we would try to stagger so like not all 10 people were smoking while this one person didn't smoke in this room. But anyway, you know, a year or two, maybe the very next year, it might have been you couldn't smoke in the room and everybody started quitting smoking. But, you know, Swartzwelder always smoked. And it was like, well, he's here and he's not here very often, so get him like a candy dish and that would be his ashtray. And he would sit and smoke and tell us he's crazy. Like he'd come in and say, you know, you could probably buy enough land in Rhode Island until you could eventually own enough of it. Then be the senator. Like he would have these, one time he was going to own a coffee farm. He just has a really wonderful mind.
Yeah, I got a feeling sometimes Homer or Bart would make a crazy pronouncement in the show and we think like, that's, Swartzwelder must have just said that in the room and they put it in his mouth.
Yeah, and just his stories. I mean, I don't know if he has book on Amazon.
Oh, they're great.
Yeah.
They're great. I've heard some people complain like there's too many jokes. like which I don't really find is a problem.
If a sentence goes by in one of those books and it wasn't a joke, I'm like, oh man, he got lazy on this sentence here.
You know, he's on Twitter and
that's really him? I was sure that was a fake account or something. Wow.
It is him. It is him. And he had a pilot that I know at one point he put it on there so you could at least connect to a link. So I guess it is. Oh, I wish I could think of the name.
Oh, is it Pistol Pete?
Yes. Okay. Everyone should watch it because that is so, it's like one of his books in pilot form. And it's kind of, you know, he loves cowboys. Mm-hmm. I think he, at least the last time I heard, he was living in Roy Rogers' house.
Wow.
I think it was Roy Rogers' old house. And yeah, he had very strong opinions. He loved Trigger and that, you know, Roy Rogers' horse, and he loved Dale Evans, Roy Rogers' wife. But, and then he would say, and buttermilk, which is Dale Evans' horse. And she apparently, buttermilk didn't do any tricks. Like this real like bitterness towards like, why is that horse famous?
Pistol Pete is kind of a mess and it's fun to watch, but I just find it interesting that it exists and that someone gave him a development deal to make a live action pilot. That's great.
It is like his books that are just full of these great silly jokes and it was pretty amazing.
Now we've also heard that when you're a new writer on The Simpsons, you get assigned a Marge script, or like you're probably given a Marge script. Is that Little Big Mom was your first script? Was that your pitch, or was it assigned to have a Marge script?
I don't know. I don't know about that new writers are assigned Marge scripts, but. It's sort of, but that was it was an assignment. you know, yeah, it was, I remember we were going to have a pitch out, and I was working on a story, and the story I was working on was that the Simpsons would house sit for Burns. And the reason why I wrote this, why I wanted to come, I was sort of backwards engineering because something Ron Howie had said, he just said the phrase of monkey knife fights. And I just thought that was the funniest phrase. And I was just, I think I was thinking, how could I get to a monkey knife fight? So I had come up with this pitch that the Simpsons house sit for Mr. Burns and eventually get access to his boat. And then once they're in international waters, no rules apply. And that's when they start having monkey knife fights. Mike Scully had come to me, and I was also like, oh, I can't wait to get a script and I can't wait to pitch this story. And we were going to have these pitch outs, but then the pitch outs kept getting, you know, something would come up and they would be delayed. And so, but every once in a while he would say, he would have an idea and say, okay, I just want this story done. So maybe you do it. And he had this idea, and his whole idea was that Marge gets hurt and Lisa takes over in the house. And so I was like, okay, I'll do that. And I was like, I just told him my pitch. And then he said, oh, that sounds good. We'll do that. We'll give that to John. So that ended up being a Schwartzwelder. Like, he came and then we pitched it to him, and then he ended up writing that. That became the Manson family.
Yeah, that's amazing. I didn't know that was your pitch. That's such a great episode.
Well, you know, the greatest thing about that episode is Ron Howie's pitches. No. But, you know, that's the power of the room. But yeah, so we're just like, okay, you know, that's what the assignment, you know, was Marge gets hurt and Lisa takes over. So in the room, we were just pitching out, how could she get hurt? And then at some point, somebody was, you know, we went to a bunch of things, and then we're kind of, you know, we do that thing where we have a first act is a set piece of some sort, and usually sort of starts and we realized we hadn't gone skiing yet. And then, and I know it was George Meyer who came up with a very funny idea that Marge should get hurt by, like, she should not ski, but get hurt in the lodge. Like, everybody else would, you know, ski. And then I remember at one point, as the story was going, and I'm like, you know, we're all pitching. And then at one point, I don't even remember who pitched it or how it started. And I know I was pitching there too, but thinking it was a joke that, and then Lisa will trick them into thinking they have leprosy. And I was, you know, we're all like laughing about this. And often we will sometimes go down a path that's not going to, like, you know, there's no way we could do it. But, and that's what I thought we were doing. And then I just remember at one point realizing, like, as they started talking more, I was like, oh, wait, we're actually going to do this. And so I like started writing down the notes, like, oh, okay, all right, we're going to go to a leper colony. Yay. So it was exciting for me because that was a great way to get them to go to Hawaii, because they go to the leper colony on Maui. I mean, I'm sorry, Molokai. And I'm from Hawaii. So it was the first time the Simpsons went to Hawaii, and it was very exciting.
And speaking of that episode, Little Big Mom, it is pretty famous on social media for the Stupid Sexy Flanders segment. Do you take any pride in seeing that constantly on Twitter and every other form of social media?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Especially because I think everybody probably feels that way about their first episode where they have a little, like, it feels really special and important, and, you know, yeah.
What I love about that bit is that Homer, he admits that Flanders is sexy. It's not that he's also grossed out thinking about his butt, that he knows it is a sexy butt as well.
Yeah, that's the problem, right? Like, it's his sexiness that is keeping him from being able to remember what his instructor had told him. One thing that's really brilliant about that little segment is that there's that moment where his legs split apart, and then he gets hit in the crotch with moguls.
Yeah.
That, if you listen to it, that at the record, and it was one of the first records I went to, like, I now direct a lot of the records, but that was at first, you know, you would go to the table reads and sometimes you could stop by the records, but most of the time we're writing when they're recording. But because it was my episode, I went, and so it was, so Dan, you know, like, they're like, okay, can, you know, we usually do the lines, and then we're like, look at the stage direction and go, well, are there any sounds we need here? And so he first just did, and then I remember saying, oh, it's he's getting hit with moguls, so it's sort of like a repetitive thing. And he's like, oh, okay. And then he just did it like, like it has this, these, so they animated to his vocal track, which is often the case. I mean, some things you kind of just sort of make the call that like, no, we'll let the animators do the action and we'll have the actors do over it. But because, you know, our cast is so good at sort of just putting humor in these little noises. It's not just walla. It's not just a sound. They will, you know, we do find a joke there too. But that to me was just really brilliant. Just hearing him kind of imagine, okay, what would it sound like if you were being repeatedly hit in the crotch with moguls? Yeah, and it's just a brilliant vocal.
He's a superstar, yeah. Dan casting the.
I don't want to go like episode by episode on your credit ones, but I did. Your next one was the dolphin segment on the Treehouse, and you also wrote a full Treehouse episode too. So I was curious, what's it compare writing, you know, a third of a Treehouse in the way it used to be done on Simpsons versus writing the entire episode?
I really liked the way we did it before, only because we all love the Treehouse, and it was a way to sort of spread the wealth around. And it's very difficult to write, you know, three different stories. They're hard to write in general because you really have very little time. You have less than 7 minutes to tell your story. And so everything's got to be very compressed. And, you know, it's got to be super efficient. You know, there are three different styles usually too. So it's hard to do all three. And, you know, it really is an episode that tends to get very rewritten. I mean, all of our episodes are rewritten, but with the Treehouse especially, I would say pretty much every time anybody's done where it's been all them, then they'll often be like, we don't like this segment, and that segment will just go, and then we'll just write another whole segment.
Wow.
Yeah, it happens. I mean, I'm sure it has happened not that way, but pretty much I'm thinking it tends to be, all right, we got these two, but we need that one more. And sometimes there's more than one, like write another one, and then it's like, yeah, let's come up with something else and then write another one. Yeah, so most of our shows are very, very rewritten. Mm. But I think Halloween tends to be especially so. Yeah, and I think that's part of the reason why, you know the whole thing about how we have holdovers from the season.
Oh, yeah.
So we always have, and that's done so we have a cushion in case something terrible happens. I don't know that anything ever has happened. We're like, we start the season with four episodes already pretty much done, or at least very close to it. That's why we always sort of make Halloween is always a holdover, because those episodes also have a longer post-production, because, you know, usually it takes, we always say from the table read to air, it's usually about 9 months. But the holdovers will go from the table read to the air, it would be more like a year and a month, you know. Because the Halloween episodes, Treehouses, are very hard on the animators as well. Harder. Because generally everybody looks different. There's, you know, there's just a lot more designs, and the background's going to be different. It's just, you can't depend on with, you know, I mean, we do have episodes that also do that. You know, we just recently did the episode set in Rome, ancient Rome, things like that. But those episodes are always a little bit harder because you can't pull as many stock or library images. And
You mentioned the voice direction. Yeah, I was very curious about that, like how did you get put in charge of that? And also, you've not only been the voice director for the show, but also for, you know, at least two of the Simpson video games. And how does doing it for a video game compare to the TV show? Well, at least you're credited for Tapped Out and for the Simpsons game. I will say that.
I don't know that I'm credited as like a voice director.
I believe I can double check this. Well, the Simpsons game is wrong about things sometimes.
The Simpsons game does have full animated scenes.
Yeah,
2D
yeah.
animated scenes with the full cast.
I don't know. I did not do the Simpsons game, but I did do some Tapped Out things. Although most of Tapped Out, the voices were just pulled from the library. I mean, you know, like the character things. But there were a couple of animation things, and I did direct those. I've done, there was one time, Garmin. It was early GPS, you know, little
machinery.
Like now that everybody has in the car, but before it used to be these little devices that people can put in their car, and they wanted to do one with Homer's voice on it. And I directed that. And that was a very long session. It was really long of like, turn right. Like, it was
Dan
at the roundabout. Go straight. Yeah. So Tapped Out was similar to that. But yeah. So how did I get to be a voice director? I'm not in charge of like doing it all. I did for a long time do a lot of the at least initial records. I think I just sort of started doing it during Mike Scully's when he was still on the show, and then I just kept doing it when Al took over. I think partly having done a lot of acting and improv and stuff, I sort of have a sense of what actors want to hear and how to say it, I hope.
Well, it must be tough, or maybe not, with you coming in to direct actors who have such established roles at they're more than 10 years into playing the characters when you took over. Did that make it like easier or harder to direct?
They're the easiest actors to direct because they don't have a lot of some actors will be like, don't give me a line reading, like. And sometimes, you know, it's hard to describe something. Like Nancy will sometimes go, just give me a line reading. And and Yardley will too, you know, like they'll just, because sometimes it's just easier because, I mean, it's not so much about ever changing what, you know, their character would normally do. It's really just about being somebody that was there when it was written, or at least sort of knowing these writers well enough to know what they're going for, and just helping that be translated to so that the actors understand what the writers were going for. And like I said, you know, we always try and get at least a couple takes of what was initially envisioned. And then they are always, you know, Dan will go, wait, I want to try something. And then he'll do it. And, you know, a lot of times it's really great. And, you know, and sometimes it's just, sometimes he just sort of will add a little something at a table read, and like it'll be like, oh, that's so funny. We'll like we'll put it in. And they're really great. And I mean, all of our actors are just really nice and have really just great, helpful attitudes. And Dan he's almost from another planet. He's so serene and calm. And yet funny. Usually people who are super chill and calm are not, you know, they're just chill and relaxed. Like, he's also wickedly funny, and it's a really nice combination.
Well, Carolyn, we've gone an hour now, but thank you so much for all of your time, and we have more questions. We got through about 65% of them. So if you want to come back, we got plenty of other ones to ask you.
Oh, sure. I'm so flattered that anybody would be interested, and I love to talk.
No, I mean, like, yeah, Halloween of Horror is one of my favorites of the last few years. Like, that's so, and you got Marge High. Like, that's such a great one. I love
yeah,
it.
Halloween of Horror is my favorite too. That was I love Homer in it. I love Yardley in it. I love everybody in it. And I do think that was a time when that episode, you know, Mike Anderson really liked Halloween and he directed it, and he's our supervising director, but he, you know, he doesn't direct episodes that much because he's supervising everybody else. But he did direct that one, and I think all the animators they love Halloween. So I felt like the animators were like firing on all cylinders, and the writer's room was firing on all cylinders with, you know, just because we hadn't done a canon Halloween episode, and we all love Halloween. And I thought even like Alf, and I thought the music was extraordinarily good, the score. Yeah, I love that episode.
It's a beautiful episode.
Yeah. But I guess, I mean, you know, folks should follow you on Twitter, but you have anything else you'd want to promote?
I am on Instagram too, although I don't, it's mostly my very adorable dog. But occasionally I do think I'm going to start, I was just looking at all my Simpsons stuff, and I was like, oh, I should take some pictures of these things. And because I have weird Simpsons things. So Instagram, Twitter, I don't really have anything else to promote. trying to think of some charity.
If you
that
post,
I should promote.
Oh, but thank you so
yes,
much.
Yes, thank you so much, Carolyn.
Thank you.
Feels like I'm wearing nothing at all. Nothing at all. Nothing at all.
Stupid sexy Flanders.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.